let me tell you briefly what I was actually doing on 9/11, because that'll put a little bit in context. I was actually supposed to be giving a demonstration of a freight bicycle out in the far reaches of Queens. So we started out on the Upper West Side, which is northern Manhattan near Columbia University. We were supposed to be assembling our prototypes in the World Trade Center. We were running late. We're on the subway on the way down. And on the way down, the train just comes to a halt, and we hear the train's being held here. We know one of the planes is hit. We have no freaking clue. We're making a lot of comments of a lot of people at the time were making of, you know, oh, a Cessna must have hit it. You know, it's some drunk doctor. And then we're starting to hear people making comments in the subway train. No, no, it's not, blah, blah. By the time we get to Times Square, it's a zoo. People are running every possible direction. I'm looking at Bernardo, the guy I'm with. We're carrying huge sacks of equipment. And they're saying, everything's being shut down. And this is part of my point. Everything, bullshit. It wasn't everything. It was, well, so we're walking around and we're like going past the cops and going around here, which everyone was doing, including the cops who were disagreeing with each other. And, I mean, this wasn't some kind of revolution. This was just, they were totally not dealing with this in any coherent fashion. And we figured out there was one particular subway that was going partway into Queens. So we took the subway partway into Queens, sort of in the right direction. Then we started calling car services until we could find the car service takes the rest of the way. The roads were surreal, because you get on any of the highways and you could see the towers. So no one's being normal, because you get on the towers, you get on like the Grand Central Parkway or the Brooklyn Queens Expressway, any of those, and you suddenly can see this. And people are just, we literally at one point just got out of the cab we were in where traffic was stopped, walked around a block away from the cab to get a better view. Everyone else is doing the same thing. This went on for hours and hours on and off. And we're just standing there, I mean, it's like, staring at the towers and staring at the huge plume and everything just falling apart. And just sort of all the norms were just sort of thrown away. And we go back to the cabbie was one of the people who walked off with us. So Bernardo and I and the cabbie leave his cab on a Manhattan highway. This is not a thing people normally do. With the doors left open, just sort of walk off going, turn around, get back in the cab. Eventually it gets going. We get all the way out to Queens. The demonstration was weird. That's a whole other discussion. One of the things that was going on, and this is one of the things to remember, is a stunningly beautiful day. But there had been all sorts of like weird, random shit going on. One of the things, and I don't want to say claim this is some great conspiracy, but one of the things that happened was there had been a flood out of this big... Any of you guys biking people? Any of you guys in the whole bike... Do you know Worksman Cycles? They make a lot of the big heavy-duty utility cycles and so on. That's where we were. And they've just been massively flooded. So their whole setup in that building, and I get the impression a little bit around it, is just they've got like fans all over the place trying to clear everything out. We then turn around. Well, everything's turning on. I mean, the phones aren't consistently working. They're not consistently not working. The cell phones are not consistently working. They're not consistently not working. I mean, everything's just here this is working, here that's working, here this is. It was just a zoo. One of the things to remember is that one of the big cables for a lot of the telecommunications traffic, I think it was Citibank. I mean, the fundamental nature of the internet, at least before our wonderful modern modifications of it, was that it rerouted traffic based on damage. And it sounds like I'm changing the subject, but I'm kind of not. I mean, do you guys understand that the internet was originally designed to survive a nuclear war?
Yes. It was all hardwired, yes.
Right. But it's not just the hardwiring. That's not unusual. The hardwiring wasn't unusual. What was unusual, it's like Robert's Rules of Order. It was the rules everyone was supposed to obey, you know, everyone meaning the computers, right, in terms of what if something goes wrong. And it was all designed that if you get knocked out, I go by you instead. So things very typically don't shut down. They slow down and get patchy. So there was this huge cable that got blown out. People were having all these problems with all these things along the tunnels and bridges. So, and all these things were routed through the World Trade Center. You've got to realize part of what was going on is all these antennas were up there. So suddenly all the antennas are gone. Everyone's trying to reroute, but it was just too big a scale. So again, things seem to kind of work. They kind of seem not to work. One of the things I think may actually have affected coverage in some small ways, I used to do tech support for Time Magazine. So I was actually on the phone with Time Magazine while this was happening, saying, you know, dudes, do you need help? I basically was calling them up asking if they needed me to come in. And they said, actually, they'd had some weird scheduling problem, and everyone was actually stranded there. But they couldn't leave. So they're like, fuck no, we've got more people than we know what to do with. So we're going to be doing tons of coverage. We've got everything. Because it was very hard to get out of the city. It was actually not that hard to get in. Why? That doesn't make sense to me. But I think a lot of it was perception. Because the truth is, the kind of people who were trying to get into the city, it was sort of a finite, okay, I want to get 3 miles. But people who lived out in Westchester are counting on the highways actually functioning worth a damn. In other words, if you're trying to go 30 miles and you hear the roads are a disaster, then in your perception, the road is shut down. If you're 2 miles away, fuck it, I'll walk. Who cares? So we then did our demo. We found a cab that took us partway. We walked over to a bus. The bus took us partway. We walked around a mile. We found another bus that took us partway. Then we split off, and I took a train that went into the city from around halfway out in Queens. Keep in mind, this is like 3 in the afternoon, maybe. Now, one of the things that was going on with all this is that our delightful mayor, should I assume that everyone here knows about the bunker?
Yeah. I mean, World Prisoner 7, you mean?
Yeah. The whole issue that Giuliani had taken all of the emergency procedures for all the city agencies and moved them to inside the bunker. Well, one particular thing I personally got to deal with is I had a friend who was one of the people routing nurses for the New York City schools. In other words, she was a supervising nurse, and her normal job is just, okay, we need to do these immunizations in this school today. We'll take these people, send them there. Well, all of their emergency tracking records for doing that kind of thing had been moved to the fucking bunker. So they had no data on people's home contact information. They're trying to route nurses down there. They're calling around going, does anybody know Sarah's number? Does anybody know, you know, and they're spending hours and hours calling around. And doing this just based on, well, I've got a friend who used to be in that school here, and maybe she can find someone. I mean, part of the reason the response was so incoherent is that Giuliani had stripped the records out of all these city agencies.
Stuck them in that
building.
Interesting in and of itself.
Well, he was a control freak, to put it very mildly. I mean, he'd been a control freak when he was 17. I mean, his father was a failed mafioso. I mean, this is, you know, Giuliani, you know, who got arrested for soliciting because he was constipated. I mean, you've got to... Do you guys know about that? I mean, it's actually... You should look into Giuliani's background. Literally, his father was constipated. And he would sit there doing squats in the bathroom so that he could go to the bathroom. And he got arrested for being gay because some cop thought he was trying to pick up another guy in the John. I mean, Giuliani started out obsessed with power. He started out having to prove that he wasn't, you know, some kind of weird faggot loser like his father, you know, in perception. But,
oh my God.
So basically, I'm in the office for the city schools for their nurses, which is, keep in mind, all the way up on Hunter Street. So it's this little building next to a public library, and everyone's just totally making it up as they go. There is no formal procedure. I mean, don't take this wrong. I'm not a 9/11 person, but I've gotten a little bit of a sense, and from what I'm hearing from you, I get more of the same sense of an assumption of coherency. And if there was anything that was consistent in everything I saw, it wasn't diddly shit in charge. It was a lot of people randomly making things up as they went, which frankly is also, again, don't take this wrong. I don't know how long you guys have been in Oregon, but New York, people always make it up as they go. I mean, one of the things that always surprises me living out here is that no one ever says, well, I'll cut you a deal. I mean, one of the things I was used to in New York is that, of course, there's always little side stuff that's off the books. There's always, oh, you're a regular customer, I'll cut you a little bit of a discount, I'll give you some extra. Oh, yeah, well, that's not officially available yet, but, you know, you're not going to give me trouble about it, so I'll get it to you anyway. You cannot look at anything, the police, the fire department, anything in New York City, and say, the procedure is X, thereby what will happen is X. The procedure is X, thereby that's what we do unless we get around to having a reason to do something else. And you've got to realize the firefighters were running from wherever the fuck. You know, there were guys literally running through the Lincoln Tunnel, just sort of rushing in, going, oh shit, and, you know, running in underneath the city. I mean, the Port Authority cops, even more so. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, one of the things that's very important, I mean, I assume you guys all know that disproportionately the people who really died, the cops and fire, especially the cops who died, were not New York City cops. They were Port Authority cops. And all this stuff about the New York City cops going in, disproportionately, it wasn't them. It was the Port Authority cops. The Port Authority was being run by an anti-abortion activist who'd been put in as a political favor by Pataki. This is... I mean, this is not... things are seldom what they seem. And it's not that there was someone doing some huge conspiracy in a lot of these cases. It's that it was 87... It was 350 years of side deals all suddenly falling apart. All these systems where it's okay, we don't really need to follow the procedure, no one's ever going to notice. When things go up to that scale, if you've always... You don't really need to know that, and it's okay because we can always check with it later. The more of a crisis you get into, the more that causes you real problems. So, anyway, so 9/11 happens. I deal with helping this nurse however I can. Spend the next couple of days doing various stuff. That's another... But to go to one specific thing, what the media has claimed is that the relief efforts that were going on in Lower Manhattan were being done almost entirely by the Red Cross and the Salvation Army. And that they set up these wonderful centers that did this great job, and things came in from all over America, and these good, solid Christian organizations went in and fixed it all for America. That's not what happened. The Red Cross famously... Talk to people who deal with the Red Cross in emergency areas. Both the Red Cross and the Salvation Army, what they're famous for providing is bologna sandwiches and coffee. Because if you're in an emergency, what you really need is cheap starch, salt, and things that will dehydrate you.
Yeah.
Oh, hell yeah. And that was, in short, what they were doing. The enormous Salvation Army Center that was supposedly this great place they were going to be doing all this was basically building after building after building after building along 14th Street that were set up as an enormous glorified routing center for homeless services. So they were totally not equipped for this. They had zero in the way of real emergency services there. So what they're doing is they're just basically, everyone's just handing them stuff and they're blowing it. The weather's gone from glorious to pouring rain. They've got all the stuff sitting in cardboard boxes on the sidewalk in the rain. Their whole philosophy is very much built around the Salvation Army in particular is a right-wing Christian organization. That's what they fundamentally are. And honestly, if you want to understand the Salvation Army, work with them for 9 or 10 hours, because it's hard to grasp how fundamentally their systems, their fundamental ways of doing everything, are built around philosophy. And that fundamental philosophy is a particular kind of right-wing Christianity. And that right-wing Christianity is built around the concept of service. But service is not rated in terms of how virtuous you are by how much you help people. It's rated by how much you exert yourself. Which means if I sit there and I take a little pebble and I carry it across the room and put it down, and I pick up the same pebble and I put it back across the room, and I did it for 15 hours, then I have worked hard and Jesus will love me. If somebody else takes 10 minutes to go out and make a phone call and save 300 lives, well, shit, man, you didn't do anything. Jesus don't care about that. And what they were doing, their whole way of approaching things, was designed quite literally to maximize effort. To maximize waste. Because the more you waste, the more virtuous you are. So they're having people, they're unloading trucks, and they're having people pick up a box in the truck. Keep in mind, it's pouring rain. I mean, we're skipping to Thursday, which is the first day I'm really dealing with. This is September 14th, I guess. Literally, they have guys walking out to a truck, walking into the truck, pick up a box, walk through the truck, go down, walk across, carry the box all the way into the building, turn around, do it again. Like ants. And this is the worst possible way you can do this. They're not doing anything to get cover from the rain, and they're meaning the vast majority of the weight each person carrying is themselves walking a quarter of a block when they should just be standing there passing it along. So there are several other people like me, basically various New York weirdo leftists, who are showing up and trying to help and being blown off. Because I've dealt with this kind of thing before, I was real quiet. And Thursday night, I did nothing but be a good little boy. And I spent the whole night in the rain, intentionally taking the worst jobs, because they care about virtue. And the guy who's willing to stand there in the rain and hold the boxes in the worst place and hold the door open, he's a good man. And after I'd been doing that for around 4 or 5 hours, then I go to the guy in charge, a guy by the name of JT, whose name you will hear again, and I say, look, I do this for a living. You know, I manage projects like this. And I think you guys really need some help. Let me talk to someone. So he says, oh, okay. And after a while, he brings me upstairs to their command center, which is totally improvised and badly set up. And they're all standing around sort of... And I am introduced to Colonel Schmoke, who's this, you know, late 50s skinny white guy who's the kind of person who in a movie would be played by the police chief in L.A. Confidential. You know, stereotypical tall, skinny WASP who's very much in charge and in a lot of cases doesn't really know what's going on. And they say, okay, cool, come back tomorrow. Now, I was there for several hours. I'm giving you the short form. And I can tell you there was one question, one question that I was asked repeatedly by other people there, because that was what they were worried about. Their highest priority was, what's the uniform of the day?
What?
Salvation Army pretends it's an army. Okay. They pretend they're a military. And there's different uniforms you wear for different activities.
Okay.
Which jacket? Do you wear your tie? Do you wear the open collared shirt? Do you wear your vest? Do you wear such and such whatever? They were not asking, are people dying? They were not asking, what are we doing about the PCB fumes from the generators? They were not asking, how are we routing our food? Do we have refrigeration? They were saying, which uniform do you think we're supposed to wear tomorrow? Have you heard yet? That's what these people were like. So I turn around and I go home and I get a few hours of sleep, and I was under the impression I was being sent down to the pile. And so I show up the next morning with my messenger bag, with my huge flashlight and my heavy gloves and all my equipment I use to go off into like abandoned buildings and things like that. And they say, well, we need someone down there, but we really need somebody here. So I said, cool, let me at least do something here, because you guys clearly have zero clue. And what I can tell you is, if I had to reduce it down to one sentence, it is that for the next several days, what you had was a building owned by the Salvation Army grudgingly conceding that a bunch of weirdo leftists were going to save people's lives in ways that didn't make them comfortable. I was running the day shift of organizing things. The guy running the night shift was a gay set designer who showed up every day in a rainbow sweatshirt to make damn sure I am a homosexual. You know, the guy who was, it was like pagans and gays and anarchists and all of us, like, we're actually flexible thinkers. We're used to this shit. You know, we're used to doing stuff in the squats. This is not a big deal for us.
And who cares if you're Christian or gay or whatever?
Well, but the thing is, but it's not about gay per se. It's
right.
About the fact that we were flexible enough thinkers that we could do things like say, look, if we need shelving, okay, why don't we take those plastic boxes, line them up there, put planks on them. Hey, we've got shelving.
Yeah, yeah.
I was going around room after room after room. They had all these rooms set aside for prayer meetings. It's September 15th, and they're keeping rooms empty because a few days from now we need it for a prayer meeting. And we don't want to have to rearrange the chairs. And you can hear how angry I am, you know, all these years later. I was quietly on the edge of rage and saying, I don't really give a shit. You're going to rearrange this room now. If you don't like it, talk to Dean Satterley. Dean Satterley being the one comparative higher-up who seemed like he was a relatively young guy. He was a captain, I believe. He was the only guy in the hierarchy there who actually seemed like he was capable and wanted to get things done there. It's worth noting he had just recently been moved back from Central America. And he has since been routed back out. Every single person, with the exception of JT, who was at all capable in 9/11, has since been moved out of the country. Every single one of them. Whoosh, all gone. But I'm basically grab JT and a couple of the other guys who are, you know, physical plant people and say, what's going on to this room, this room, this room, this room, this room? Okay, empty this out, move these tables here, take these tables, stack them side by side, turn it into shelving. The whole thing that was going on, the woman who I set up tracking a lot of the endless people were coming, driving in from as the days passed, came from further and further away. People were showing up who'd driven from Minnesota. I mean, insane stuff. But what they're carrying is whatever random thing they thought to carry. It's very much built around sentiment, not around effectiveness. So they'll have two shopping bags that contain three $1 gas masks, you know, gas masks, little things you get at Home Depot, a couple of sandwiches, and a big plate of potato salad that's already gone bad, and then 20 sets of work gloves, because that was what they could think to do. So a huge amount of what's going on is trying to say, okay, intake is take all these bags, completely disassemble them. Refrigerate what we can, get everything down there we can. Then reorganize it all, recluster it, get in downtown. Now keep in mind, the police department and the military are not allowing anything down those streets. Those streets, when you're over on the side that the... do you guys know the general layout of that part of Manhattan? Do you guys... basically, the World Trade Center was all the way off in a corner, all the way down at the tip of Manhattan. And this whole section was just gone, just shut off. And there were huge military vehicles moving day and night along here, doing all these deployments that didn't really seem to protect anything. Now again, this whole thing about the police, both the police and the military, what they guarded was the police and the military. Generators were not protected. Hospitals were not protected. Train stations were not at that point protected. Every single police precinct had guys standing there with machine guns protecting it.
Well, they have all this stuff they've stolen from people for years of protect, don't they?
Well, but in terms of... but, I mean, one of the things... I mean, again, you guys have been focusing a lot on the engineering of the building and things like that, and what conspiracy things are going... in terms of a lot of the statements the Bush administration was saying, of we're in high alert against terrorists, what I can tell you is what was going on in New York City in those days afterwards. A bunch of my friends and I had sat around in the early 90s and mapped out, if we were going to take out New York, what would we do? So we actually put quite a bit of time to thinking it out. You know, where are the vulnerable points on the bridges? Where are the vulnerable generators? Where would you set off a low-level nuke? It's just, we were curious. And I knew pretty well where all the major generators were, all the substations were, where the, you know, there are huge vulnerabilities in the city. None of them. You could walk right up to the buildings. It took them a couple of days. They finally started realizing the enormous power plant on 14th Street on the other side of the city was an unbelievable vulnerable point. The huge power plants in Long Island City. Oh, right. Oops. They're huge, you know, the St. Vincent's Hospital, all these things that in the real world, if you're worried about somebody taking out a city, you protect as, you know, your highest assets. Not a goddamn thing. All of the police and to some extent the military were protecting the police and the military.
I just have a couple of questions about
that.
Okay, so besides just carrying their weapons and looking tough and protecting themselves and their facilities and vehicles, were they doing anything else in terms of crowd control or...
No. No. Absolutely not. They were, in fact, this is a very important point. They were given no rules of engagement. Should I assume you guys know what rules of engagement are? You know. Do you guys know? Rules of engagement, if there's any of you who don't know, are when you send a soldier out, when you send somebody out with a gun into a potential conflict situation, the first thing you do is say, if these are the points where you raise your gun and you fire. These are the points where you use your bayonet. These are your points. And so I was walking up to military and saying, so, what have they told you to do? Hey, man, I don't know. The sergeant just told me to stand here.
You know, that almost proves that they were admitting off the top there never was a terrorist threat. I think those were all for show, sending all these guys out so the cameras could pan and a whole bunch of military people.
Oh, don't worry about any other
of course not.
See, because they already
knew it was they had done it or some team had done it.
I'm not going to say anything about why. All I'm going to tell you is what I saw.
So
honestly, I feel like, you know, I'm going to stick to what I personally saw, what I personally experienced.
Right. Well, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
With all that experience, did you never ask the question about why this happened? Why, I mean,
well, first of all,
did you just build a wall?
First of all, in that first couple of weeks, it was, in fact, I can tell you, that first night when I'm standing around waiting in the Salvation Army, I mean, first night for me, which is because the first couple of days I was doing stuff we're not even going to get into. I mean, people were literally having psychotic breaks. It was an interesting few days.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, I did not until around a year ago ever see footage of the buildings going down. Honestly, I felt it was as much as I could do to just get my job done. That there were, I mean, a lot of the points that they weren't talking about that I've mentioned in brief, there were huge toxicity issues from the generators going. Somebody had to bloody well figure out how to get the right gas masks to the right people in the pile. And that was me for a good part of that. Somebody had to do things. I mean, this is the kind of mundane shit that people don't pay attention to who don't do this for a living. One of the things a bunch of us really had to agitate for is we found a caterer to actually get healthy food to the people in the medical examiner's office. The guys in the ME's office were working 24 hours a day. and they were sending them and the guys down at the pile, again, an endless succession of crap. So we were going around and we found a caterer, and we found some refrigerator trucks, and the caterer was making huge quantities of things like veggie dumplings. Because we contacted the caterer and said, this is what we need. We need stuff with water-soluble vitamins. We need stuff that you can or cannot eat with your hands. You know, there were huge arguments. The Salvation Army was very upset about, we don't want anybody using finger food because they might get dust on their stuff. And then other people were saying, no, it absolutely has to be finger food because they can't be sitting with a plate. So we're doing both, you know. Can we get them huge trays of lasagna? Can we, you know, anything that has some actual vitamins in it that isn't caffeinated or overly salted? That was as much as I could do. I mean, honestly, I had repeatedly brought people down to the World Trade Center was an obvious vulnerable spot point to me. I had several times taken people visiting New York, brought them down to stand between the two buildings, said, look up. Someday this is all going to blow up and you're going to see people falling down there.
So,
I said that.
Why did you say that?
Because it was an obvious vulnerable point.
I
knew this for years. No, it was honestly the first thing that got my attention.
So did you have anything for
no.
Chrissy Whitman sending all these people down there? Days after, you know.
The thing is, there were dozens and dozens of teams sending people to. I mean, that's. I don't want to talk about that because I wasn't involved in it. I was involved. I don't. I mean, that's. We could get into that some other time. But to answer the question of was I thinking about that? I was as busy as I. So anyway, I had thought in great detail about what would happen if the World Trade Centers really went down. I had very detailed images in my head of what would happen if they really. I assumed bombed. I'd never really given the specifics much thought. Just someday they're going to take the damn thing out. And honestly, my actual, I skipped a step on actual 9/11. Because what I actually did was I managed to feel pretty calm and reasonable on 9/11 going out to Queens and back out to the city. And keep in mind, I'm getting phone calls from people saying, oh my God, can you do this? Can you do that? Oh my God, have you seen so-and-so? Do you know where so-and-so is? You know, I finally get my voicemail. It's like 9 different people. Are you okay? I mean, several of my friends knew I was supposed to be in the building. And honestly, I did just fine until I made it to the nurse's office. And I made it to the nurse's office, and for the first time, I'm hearing the radio going. And I'm hearing them talking about the people falling out of the building, or jumping, or, you know, all the stuff that's going on with that. And I started feeling nauseous. And I just barely made it back to my apartment, and I spent the next hour projectile vomiting, frankly. Because I knew too much of what this could mean. And then, honestly, I spent the rest of my time cleaning up the vomit before my friend the nurse showed up needing somewhere to sleep. And trying to, like, get Visine in my eyes so that, because, you know, when you really projectile vomit, your eyes get all blown out. So I'm, like, you know, trying to find some way to cut the redness in my eyes and have my face not look so bad. Because if a nurse walks in and sees that you've been vomiting over and over again, she's probably going to be a little upset. The truth is she didn't give a damn. By the time she got in, like, 1 a.m, she's like, it's like, okay, Marina, lie down, go to sleep, good, I'll make you something to eat tomorrow. Get her up in the morning, get her out the door. That was as much as I could manage. I did not have the energy to spare. I made a conscious decision, let me do my job.
Now, this was on 9/11.
That was on 9/11, or whatever. And the thing is, that stayed true for weeks.
Something I'm unclear on. You said you knew they were going to take it out at some point or another.
I didn't know.
About,
I didn't know or care.
Somebody.
I didn't know or care. I felt that. I mean, I've been doing military history stuff for years.
Okay.
If you guys have seen, there's a poster that's around actually the United States. Every time the U.S. military was ever in combat, that's me. I'm the one who did that. I mean, I was born in Panama, you know, both my father and my stepfather were in the army, you know, I'm well aware that there's a lot of people pissed at our country, and I was certainly after 93 who could possibly not be aware.
Yeah.
And it was obviously someone was going to take it back, somebody was going to turn back towards us, that was my assumption.
Well,
my assumption was we had so many enemies in so many places, this was a really obvious vulnerable spot, and on top of everything else, I was working tech support for Time Magazine when the 2000 New Year's Eve was going on, and the Time Magazine building is in the secure area they separate off before New Year's Eve, and so they actually took a bunch of us and sat us down and said, so, red team this situation for us. You're going to take out the city, or you're going to start with Times Square. What do you do? And so I sat down with an ex-Army Ranger and a guy who'd made his way across the Berlin Wall and a couple of extreme sports guys and a couple of other techies and at least one hacker. And we said, okay, so we're going to take the city out. What do we do? And we got paid to sit there for hours and say, well, let's see if we put a bomb here and here and if we release toxics there and there. So I gave the matter a lot of thought. And I just felt it was all I could do to focus on getting things done.
Who was paying for you guys to do this focus group?
Well, that was Time Magazine. Okay. That was because they were worried. Well, they were worried about what would happen if their building got shut down.
Okay.
What we were doing was red teaming to run simulations so we could figure out what extra equipment do we need in case something happens and, you know, if Times Square gets hit by some kind of infectious agent and Time Magazine is nine blocks away or somebody is setting off explosives along the because the Times the ball is right near where Time Magazine's building is or was in those days. So, I mean, I'd given the matter some thought.
So let me raise the question again. Yeah. With all of that.
It actually was a lot of fun to be paid to do that.
Did you raise the question then from that perspective? How did this happen?
The thing is, people were already by a day or two later saying this was some kind of a controlled demolition.
Are you serious? Because, like, New York is saying that?
People were saying everything.
Okay.
But people were saying all sorts of stuff. I mean, the number of things people were saying. And honestly, initially I didn't pay that much attention. And
we're in a meeting, so I'm going to let you go.
I felt like I didn't, what are we talking about, a week after, a month after, a year after, 5 years after, what?
At any point, I mean,
in 1 year.
I'm really curious to know your actual opinion. I mean, if it differs from mine, I mean, so be it, but I mean.
Okay, let me sound like I'm changing the subject, but I'm not.
Sir, you had a question at some point.
Oh, that's okay.
Okay.
I wish I could remember the year. If I had to guess, I would say it was 93. There was a lead story on the front page of the New York Times about Area 51. And no, but it's interesting because it was the front page of the New York Times, and it was the U.S. military officially saying, well, we've always lied to you before, but what we really meant to say was that it was, I don't even remember what the story was, but it was transparently impossible. It was, you know, what you thought was an alien was somebody who'd been in a fire, and it was a weather balloon, and the weather balloon only looked like a B-15 or whatever. I don't even remember what the particulars were. But I'm reading the story, and it's like when you see what Microsoft does, and Microsoft came out with DOS, and they said, DOS is wonderful. Windows systems are horseshit. They don't work. And so then they say, oh, remember everything we sent you about Windows systems? We were lying. What we really meant is we've got this wonderful thing called Windows 3.1, and everything we always sent you before now was a lie. But the truth is, Windows are great, but Windows 3.1 is much better than Macintosh. And then they come out a few years later, remember everything we said about Windows 3.1? We were lying. But what we really mean is, and when someone keeps lying to you over and over and over again, after a certain point, you stop being interested in what it is. All that you do know is there's some weird shit going on. And when the New York Times carried that story from the U.S. military about Area 51, I lost interest in trying to determine what was happening with whether there were or were not aliens. But I lost interest in the belief that there wasn't anything. That as far as I'm concerned, the only thing I can count on is something weird's going on. Because if nothing weird was going on, they wouldn't have to keep lying to us over and over and over and over and over again, and every time saying, oh, but this time we're telling the truth. Really, we mean it. And frankly, I mean, if you guys, I don't know, if you guys are serious about understanding a lot of this engineering stuff, there's a magazine you should look into called Engineering News Record. Engineering News Record is the big magazine that the actual civil engineers who do projects like this read. And it's where the ads from Schlumberger on new tracking technologies and the ads for new kinds of steel girders and fireproofing technology and so on. This is where they spend their time. I was their IT director for over a year. And, you know, I personally used to know, I sort of know, do you guys know Parsons Brinckerhoff is one of the big contracting firms. They're, I don't know if they're as big as Halliburton, but they're mighty big. And they did a lot of the original design on the World Trade Center. I mean, on a civil engineering standpoint, I know the guy who was in charge of part of that project. And I was sitting there at Passover that year. I'm almost done. And I'm sitting there talking to a guy who I'd known since 1984, who I know was a civil engineer involved in the World Trade Center, hearing what he has to say about the project. And what I've seen is there's an awful lot of weird shit, and frankly, I'm busy enough for the rest of my life. Honestly, I know there were planes that hit, because I know plenty of people who saw them hit.
Oh, I believe it.
But I know that steel does buckle like that in fires. I was in a fire. I was, you know, I got exploded in 2004.
Right.
I've seen steel buckle. I've seen steel do things. I mean, I melted a matchbox car when I was a kid with airplane glue in a cardboard box
right.
and aluminum foil. Am I absolutely sure there were no controlled demolitions? I don't know. Do I think there's any chance whatsoever the government knew nothing ahead of time? That's ridiculous. They weren't letting people fly. All the stuff that was going on a couple of days before that, somebody knew something. Beyond that, honestly, not only do I not know, I think it's unlikely I'll take the time to do enough research of sources I really trust to reach a firm conclusion about what happened.
Oh, just a question.
I was wondering, you were talking about how horrible the Red Cross is. Everything up and the police
are
doing the military. Where was
FEMAR?
Where was
the
who?
Yeah,
who?
Sure,
who
are those people? I've heard of them. They're the ones who are building the camps out in the desert, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
So where was the sort of U.S. government point agency that was supposed to be figuring out which masks to give to which people on which pile?
I never heard a word about that from anybody I was dealing with. What I was seeing was guys coming up from the pile needing to sleep, making this shit up as they went. What I was seeing was I was talking to people who were involved in toxicity issues, and we were saying, what do we think we should do with what we are finding? I didn't hear any... I mean, the Salvation Army people just kind of stood around going, And eventually Colonel Shoak, whatever the hell his name is, did go off, Shoak, something like that. I'm sure he's in all the records. He went off and had a meeting with George Bush, and he took me aside for a while to talk to me and give him a briefing before he had his meeting with Bush. And then he came back afterwards and said the Salvation Army had just been awarded $50 million for their having done such a wonderful job, which made me want to kill the son of a bitch. It's like, you don't even know what happened here, and you just got $50 million? Whatever. But what I do know is they were not getting a lot of input from the government on things like toxicity. We know by now that there were... I mean, this is... We could have a whole other conversation about that. As it happens, I've actually worked with Maggie Clark, who was one of the people who started the tracking of toxicity down at the World Trade Center site. So, I mean, we could have that whole other discussion, but I wasn't hearing anything about that. Not a syllable. We were making this up as we went.
Something I'd like to mention to you about FEMA, they're not what you think. All their resources are designed and centered around COG, or continuity of government. Throughout the entirety of the Cold War, and please research this, please.
No, I'm off the skin on this stuff.
Okay,
I just
cool.
wanted to know
okay.
if the agency was there, or, I mean, pretty wild. To think
they don't waste their resources if it's
right, but
COG.
At the same time, it's hard for me to conceive of that whole scene happening and then some government agency not having a point. At all.
Well, one of the things you have to remember, I mean, one of the things I was talking about with Glenn, honestly, one of the things that was going on in those few days is there were tons and tons of people showing up with their little home video cameras and taking shots of what was going on where we were on 14th Street. And what I saw was the Salvation Army consistently routing them away from anything useful because they wanted it to look like they were in charge. So they were trying to route away, the people who were showing up from NBC were being routed away from what actual productive work. The people from the New York Times were being routed away from actual productive work. But there were tons of normal schlubs just living in the neighborhood, or who were there, who'd just gotten out of their cars to bring out 10 shopping bags, who were taking tons of footage of us other normal schlubs who were the ones actually doing the work. Frankly, I think there's been a real lack of effort to go out and collect those images and put them on a public archive. And if you guys really are trying to figure out some way to put together more data, try and team up with some people to put out an effort on the web, because a lot of these people were not New Yorkers. They really just drove in from everywhere and say, if you were in New York in those couple of days and you photographed any of those relief efforts at the 34th Street Depot, at the area near that at Javits, the medical examiner's office at 14th Street, at the line along Canal Street where they tried to prevent photography and didn't really succeed, at the areas along the East Village, if you took photographs of what was going on there, we want you to post, give us image copies of those images.
I was just making a comment about Al-Qaeda and bin Laden. Throughout the mid-1980s, when I was a kid, it was all over the newspapers. We raved about how great he was. It was in the New York Times as a great hero of, you know, fighting the Soviets in Afghanistan when we were having the Army Rangers train them and teach them how to, you know, do things like...
Well, we were hearing about the Taliban, not about Al-Qaeda. No, Al-Qaeda and Taliban are two different groups.
You're right.
It's very important.
They were raving about bin Laden. You can look at the old microfiche and see that they held him, herald him as a hero.
What are those locations in New York City that you mentioned?
One is the Salvation Army Depot at 14th Street between 7th and 8th. One is, I know there was a huge effort going on around the Javits Center, which is what everyone says 34th Street. It's actually 34th to 39th, all the way on the far west side. Then there were supposedly some efforts being done to try and do very early data collection connected to the medical examiner's office. I've heard conflicting things about that. All I know is people mentioned it a hell of a lot in those few days. The next is there was an enormous effort to collect resources and collect blood and things like that at the downtown hospitals, which they turned out not to need, but they didn't know that at the time. So St. Vincent's Hospital, downtown NYU, to the extent anyone could get to downtown NYU.
How long have you been in Portland since you moved from there?
I've been coming and going a long time. I actually lived here for a few years in the 80s. I've been coming and going here, since 85.
I wonder how much, what the dollar value on a unit of plasma is.
I would guess at
a minimum, even in the most depressed market, $100.
Frankly,
but probably more than
I do know some of those doctors at places like Beth Israel. And they were just doing whatever the hell they could think of to do.
I'm sure.
I don't know what the high-level officials were doing, but I know there were a lot of people just, they wanted to do something. And the radio stations are saying, give blood. Yeah, sure, that works. Because it was just, they'd all been conditioned to believe when something's bad, give blood, that helps. They couldn't think of what to do.
Well, they can always use the blood somewhere else.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. Frankly, so there were people saying, we certainly need it. Yeah, it was a good excuse. Well, they'll do it. Cool. We've always got shortages of AB. We're delighted. Yeah.
You know, when he mentioned the trucks moving out, you had a comment about that.
I'm trying to remember what was about the trucks.
First of all, beans.
That, in terms of beans being taken out to Fresh Kills, Fresh Kills is an enormous and complicated subject, and I saw those trucks being started, stopped, moved, rerouted. That was an enormous, inconsistent effort as well. I mean, that pile was burning for weeks, and there were, first of all, a lot of that stuff was never making it to the trucks. It was being put on barges. So they had... I'm only going to talk about what I personally saw.
Okay.
What I personally saw, because I was down there, I actually got a chance to go on the roof of a building two blocks away, which could see the barges in one direction and could see the pile in the other and could see the trucks going back and forth.
Did you ever raise the question that was fooling with a crime scene? Why were they taking all those things away? You know, like that within the first few days, did that ever cross your mind?
I don't remember. I'm trying to think about it. Honestly, the biggest impression it made on me was the sheer physics of the fact that they were hosing down the stuff as it went across to the barges. And it just seemed like they were doing what it most. The impression I got just from seeing what they were doing was it seemed really, really haphazard. It just seemed really sort of frantic and ill-considered.
So, wait, you mean the material was so hot that they had to steady spraying it as it was
being taken out of the pile.
As it was being taken out of the pile.
And then they're still hosing it on the barges.
So still burning, like, underneath it. Like, they're hosing it to keep it cool on the barges. That much intensity.
And huge clouds of steam coming off of things as they're hosing it down.
Okay,
as far as physics is concerned, okay, that much energy being built up and maintained by a petroleum product or jet fuel kerosene, okay, does it make any damn sense to me?
Well, I was going to say, you look and you think that it's smoking, but it may not be smoking. It's fuming. And that's what Judy Wood is saying in her physics, that the particles are going.
You were saying you were homeless for quite a while, so I assume you've done a lot of fires.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume, just like, you know, something to keep you warm. If you bank a fire, you can come back 2 or 3 days and still, if you bank it right, and still have heat down in the center.
Right.
In terms of the sheer number of joules that were involved, first of all, the jet fuel is, you know, what we could, you know, jokingly, if we assume that it's all, I'm just going to, just to simplify, I'm going to assume that what they're saying is true, because it's just, that's a whole other discussion.
Sure.
But
ahead,
just starting with the fact that some kind of an accelerant set off a fire on that scale, there were an awful lot of other burning things.
Yeah.
And heat disperses proportional to surface area.
Right.
It accumulates in proportion to mass.
Yeah.
The larger something gets, the longer it takes to disperse. No, not really. Because not a random pile of stuff like that. That's a very bad conductor of heat. Relative to something on that scale, I mean, mine fires, they've had problems for 2 years later, they're still trying to put the damn things out. Once things start getting on that scale, it can take an enormous amount of time to disperse things. I mean, to see it in the opposite direction, one of the things that was just being talked about in this room a couple of weeks ago is the classic thing that they did from ancient times up until we lost our common sense 100 years ago, where you'd have ice houses that just consisted of a house lined with straw, and you'd put ice in there in January and be able to take it out in August. And the good ice houses were huge, but you could do ice houses that were tiny. And that insulation really was quite effective for months.
Okay.
So something on that scale will still be that hot after a day later or a week later. It's not an issue at all. Not at all.
Just a comment on that.
Yeah.
Even if the fires from the jet fuel were hot enough to melt girders on the 3 or 4 affected stories that the plane hit, and that those girders on those few stories that the plane hit melted enough to bring the rest of the top part of the building above, down, and then the rest collapsed by weight. Still, what that tells me is that only 3 or 4 stories out of a 110-story building got hot enough to melt. The rest should have collapsed by weight. And so only not more than 5% of that steel should have been, by the official story, that hot.
And what happened to the freaking concrete? I'm sorry. Where's 110 stories of concrete?
Yeah,
that's amazing. It leaked into the air and fly across. How far did that dust cloud? That went almost to the
Okay, what's worrying me is that we're now passing from things I know very well to things I don't know as well.
Yeah.
What I can tell you is that actually that cloud went 60, 70 miles in some cases. In fact, enormous percentages of that dust. If you want to find out what happened with that dust, you know who the best person to talk to would be? I believe his name is Lasky, the council member for Brooklyn. In New York City, was in, actually, if you can find it, and
see, the first thing I was able to confirm was New Jersey as far as it went, but it went 60 or 70.
It was, there were bits of that going a long goddamn way. People were finding pieces of paper, office memos from the World Trade Center in parks that were, you know, 20 miles away. The scale of this really is not what you're used to. And if you're interested in the numbers of where that plume went and where that dust went, then, yeah, contact Lasky's office. Because the Brooklyn Council council member, has been fighting with the EPA for years to get funding for all the dust that went down into that area, none of which has ever been acknowledged by the government. So they can he can give you chapter and verse. What I can tell you is the New York City Council in I would guess February of 2005. February of 2007 had their official last round of hearings on dust from 9/11. If you contact the city government, God help you. What I would recommend is you contact Alan Gerson's office. Alan Gerson is the council member for Lower Manhattan. And try and get, or contact New York One. New York One is the local television station for the equivalent of C-SPAN. New York One videotaped the whole thing. And there was a whole session on where that dust plume went and the scale of it. One of the people you will see talking about it is me. And it was, that plume, the numbers are surreal. The numbers don't seem possible. They really don't.
We need, it's almost 9 o'clock, okay. We need to do just one more bit of business. It's where are we going to meet next week?
Excellent.
Well, we can continue, but we just...